mind in matter and shown that in each case there is a greater power of consciousness at work, a new grade, as he says, of expression. And this grade is something which manifests a more complete sense of reality and a power of consciousness. And that moves us from a state of sort of inconscience in matter through a state of what he calls dream, nervous dreams in the plant consciousness, to a state of a kind of more awakened mentality in the animal, a sense mentality in the animal, and finally we find in the human being even greater wakefulness, though not fully self-conscious, still conscious only on the surface, can open more and more to his inner and integral being. So these are the three stages, and he's also talked about how at each of these stages there is a turning of this power of consciousness upon that out of which it has emerged, and giving it a new formulation, a new kind of heightening by the new consciousness that has emerged and expressed itself. We can see that in terms of the emergence of consciousness, at first in the plant, on the one hand, he's talking about a kind of a vital organization and a mentality which is unorganized. There is some kind of a mentality, the mental vital nexus over there, though he's talking about it more in terms of a nervous material sort of connection, a physical vital contact or connection. But as he develops it, one sees that even that so-called nervous part has got an organized vital, a vital that is somewhat organized, and a mentality that is unorganized. And that, in a sense, is what elsewhere he calls the chitta. And in the animal, you find a vital mental kind of nexus. And there, the mentality has begun to be organized, and we have a nervous system, not just a nervous vitality, but a nervous mentality. And that nervous system, you can say, is the operation of the manas, the senses, and a kind of a network connecting the senses to a sense mind and to a rudimentary interpretive power in the sense mind, and a slight degree of some degree of thinking, what he calls the power to strategize, the power to interpret the results of one's sensory knowledge in terms of some goals. And yet it is not a, it's a very rudimentary action of the thinking mind. And so with the human being, we have the emergence of buddhi. And with the buddhi, there is a much greater access to the laws that allow us to deal with the world around us more effectively. So that is a much more awakened and sense of reality that human beings have. And they take up the lower parts as well, the lower activities of the vital as well as of the material being, of the physical being, and turn this more reasoning mentality upon those parts of the nature as well. And then he talks about higher mental operations in the human being beyond even the basic power to reason. And he's talking about the aesthetic sense, for example. He's talking about the ethical sense. These kinds of judgments are beholden to higher powers and understandings of consciousness. An ethical sense may arise out of pure pragmatic considerations, because humankind has to share space, and therefore, you know, the whole notion of not doing unto others what one does not want done to oneself makes for a degree of social harmony for the functioning of human beings together. But an ethical consciousness can and does also point to the existence of some sense of unity, a greater sense of unity, and the results or consequences of that sense in terms of goodwill, in terms of sympathy, in terms of doing things which are not harmful to others. All these arise out of a greater awakening of consciousness at a greater, at a higher level. So to the aesthetic sense points to an awakening to some image of beauty, of delight, of oneness, of order and harmony that is ultimately an intuition of something greater beyond the mind. So in this sense, we find that each one of these levels opens up to something even higher above it and expresses certain aspects of its own sort of layer or level that correspond to those higher things, as well as turns its attention to the lower strata out of which it has come and gives them a bigger power of expression and existence.
So Devashita Shyam here.
Yes.
So so you're saying that as the newer powers come, they give the lower powers, like the mind gives the physical and the vital, a more heightened functioning. So to what degree is that different from the transformation of these parts itself?
Yeah. Actually, also, one has to be a little careful. I don't think it is, it may not be so proper to say a more heightened functioning. A heightened functioning would actually mean an intensification of these particular states of consciousness themselves. I'd say a higher functioning. A higher functioning would mean that they are made to behave or operate in ways in which they did not operate before. There is a conjunction, as it were, of the higher power of consciousness with the lower power of consciousness. Remember, this Sri Aurobindo says that every this is part of the whole aspect of continuum of consciousness, which is that every level of consciousness is present, though under the auspices of every other level of consciousness. In other words, in the vital, you have the physical, the mental, the supramental, and even the Satchidananda that are represented in some way, but acting under the laws of the vital. So too in the mental, etc. But before these higher levels of consciousness become operative, we don't actually activate those possibilities within the lower level of consciousness. So mentality in the vital, something like a vital mind, which is also different from the mental vital, would become active in the human being, because the human being, in a sense, has got this nexus between mind and vital and can activate the power of mind in the vital. Now, but this mentality would operate under the laws of the vital. It would not heighten the operation of the vital, but express a higher potentiality of the vital. So this is a modification of the vital, not a transformation of the vital. The law of the vital is still what is, operative. But we find that this law of the vital operates, you know, under the auspices, expresses certain higher capabilities that it did not express before. A transformation would mean that the law of the vital itself would get changed. That it would, for example, you know, I'm taking a kind of an analogical example, an analogy from Savitri, where you have the triple soul forces, as Sri Aurobindo calls them, right? When Savitri, in her search for a soul, encounters the triple soul forces. Now, the triple soul forces are goddesses. Each one of them represents one of the cosmic goddesses or godheads, shaktis, that is operating in this lower triple world of Vidya, as he calls it. But each one of them is operating under the conditions of the avidya. Therefore, they can do something greater than the avidya could do if they were not present. Each one of them represents some power of divinity present in the avidya, helping it to grow, outgrow itself, to grow beyond itself. But they cannot transform the avidya. And that is the reason why each one of them expresses their frustration and their inability to actually do anything beyond what they are doing. And Savitri has to seek a greater law to manifest the transformative power. That's the power of the supermind, which is not just another higher power of consciousness, but an originating power of consciousness at the origin of these other powers of consciousness.
Sure. So for the transformation itself, what is required is more the supermind or this originating consciousness acting on these lower powers and transforming them, rather than some kind of a mental rather than a mental attempt at convincing these parts.
Yes, it's very true, like that. It's I mean, to take a kind of a sort of a rough, very, very rough cut analogy, you know, matter, life and mind can kind of appear like three brothers. You have a kind of hierarchy of, you know, brothers or sisters or whatever you want to call them, of a younger and an elder in the series. But supermind would appear as a parent. And the difference basically is the parent is the originating consciousness. It actually, the so-called brothers or whatever carry the seed of that particular consciousness. And so that consciousness has a transformative power. While among these brothers, there can only be a degree of domination and a degree of respect, so to say. So it is that degree that establishes the amount of modification that is possible, but not really a transformation of the consciousness.
Yeah, okay, thank you, Devashista. Yeah. So yeah, I was reading some letters in some letters under the section Transformation of the Vital. And he goes on there to say something, I mean, pretty much this, that I think the person asking the question was along the lines of, it's not a question of using your mind's logic to tell the lower vital what to do or what not to do or why it should not do certain thing, but the only way to transform it is by having the supramental light directly work on it.
Right. Or elsewhere he'll say the mother's force.
Sure. Oops.
To a higher power, the power of the divine light, or the divine force or consciousness, and in doing so, it establishes its own relationship with its originating consciousness. That's why the surrender to the mother has to be an integral surrender made by physical, vital and mental in their own right, in their own capacity. You see, this whole idea about the dissociation of consciousness and the amalgamation of consciousness, in kind of modern psychology, there is always the sense that we have to overcome the fragmentation of the being by actually trying to create some sort of an amalgamation. But this amalgamation is only a surface formation. It is ultimately a more balanced ego. In yoga, we are asked, in fact, to ultimately know how to dissociate. Know how not to interfere. interfere with the laws of other powers of consciousness, and each one of them find their own relationship with the divine and be transformed thereby. However, this doesn't happen immediately. We start with one or the other, which is more predominant. And whatever it is, it may be that for some period of time, that has to be become the leader, until the psychic becomes the leader. And the psychic also gives us a certain degree of a originating consciousness. It is to some degree a consciousness that can directly address mind, life, and body. Before that, what you were saying, to use the power of the mind to coax and cajole, or even to deliberately sort of force through some laws or rules the actions of the vital, it is something that it's the best that we can do, but it is not good enough. That's basically what it amounts to.
So when you were talking of that amalgamation, again, that amalgamation doesn't work because there is no originating power there to have a working control of things, right?
Yeah, it doesn't work. It creates a sort of a shifting illusory sense of a more balanced personality. But ultimately, that so-called balanced personality is only a kind of a tolerable compromise between three kind of alien creatures sharing the same house.
So, thank you, Devashista. Shall we read the first paragraph?
Yes.
So are we in this paragraph which says, but man not only turns his gaze downward and around him?
I think we finished that long paragraph. But no, but when we come to man, I'm not sure which paragraph you talked about just now, Lopa, but I know the one I'm thinking, the one that we stopped at and we want to reread is, but here we have to observe two particularities of this human and at present highest development.
Okay. Got it. Meenaji, do you want to read? Oh, maybe she's muted.
Can you hear me?
Oh, yeah, we can hear you now.
Yeah. Lopa, I'm sorry, I don't have the paragraph in front of me. I'm on page 700.
Go to 714.
Yes.
And the one which starts with, but here we have to observe two particularities of this human.
Yes, just a minute. It's a different way. But here we have to observe, yes.
Yes.
That is so. But here we have to observe two particularities of this human and at present highest development, which bring us to the heart of the matter. First, this taking up of the lower parts of life reveals itself as a turning downward of the master eye of the secret evolving spirit or of the universal being in the individual from the height to which he has reached on all that now lies below him, a gazing down with the double or twin power of the being's consciousness force, the power of will, the power of knowledge, so as to understand from this new, different and wider range of consciousness and perception and nature, the lower life and its possibilities, and to raise it up, it also, to a higher level, to give it higher values, to bring out of it higher potentialities. And this he does because evidently he does not intend to kill or destroy it, but delight of existence being his eternal business and a harmony of various strains, not a sweet but monotonous melody, the method of his music, he wishes to include the lower notes also, and by surcharging them with a deeper and finer significance, get more delight out of them than was possible in the cruder formulation. Still, in the end, he lays on them as a condition for his continued acceptance their consent to admit the higher values, and until they do consent, he can deal harshly enough with them even to trampling them underfoot when he is bent on perfection and they are rebellious. And that indeed is the true inmost aim and meaning of ethics, discipline, and ascesis, to lessen and tame, purify and prepare to be fit instruments, the vital and physical and lower mental life, so that they may be transformed into notes of the higher mental and eventually the supramental harmony, but not to mutilate and destroy them. Ascent is the first necessity, but an integration is an accompanying intention of the spirit in nature.
So, yeah, he is making the case for, as he calls the chapter, ascent and integration. For both these, the coexisting powers of consciousness operating in the evolution. And as he brings it out over here in this particular paragraph, it's really the cosmic spirit that is evolving. It is evolving in an individualized form in each of us, but it is the cosmic spirit in its evolution that ultimately turns higher and higher grades of itself upon the lower powers that it has outgrown. First, this taking up of the lower parts of life reveals itself as a turning downward of the master eye of the secret evolving spirit, or of the universal being in the individual, from the height to which he has reached and all that now lies below him. And there he points to the double power of consciousness force, the power of will, the power of knowledge. This, of course, these two are the two master powers in manifestation and in expression, because ultimately it's only in the manifestation that these two twin powers, as he calls them, operate. And they take their origin in the what he calls the real idea or the supermind, because that is the knowledge will, knowledge dash will. It is only in the avidya that they split into two, the power of knowledge and the power of will. So it's both these, it's in the real idea, it's the knowledge will, because to know is to become. It is a simultaneous action. There is... immediately something is known, it manifests as a reality. It becomes. So here, on the other hand, these are two separate powers. In keeping with the whole notion of the avidya being a division of reality into its constituent parts. So both these are in action as we evolve, and they basically are the action of the downward gaze of the universal being acting in the individual. That's, he makes that very clear. And in that, he also points to the fact that this is an action that doesn't take its root in us, either as individuals, separated individuals, or as individuals limited at any particular stage of our growth, but that it is a universal being and a universal movement, that at every level it will occur, because there is no term and end to the height of the universal being. From the mind, it turns its gaze upon the life and matter of body, and then it prepares the same turning of the gaze from the supermind on mind, life, and body. That entire part about ethics and how, you know, each, and if you look at the kind of metaphors he uses there, the metaphors are metaphors of modification rather than transformation, because he is talking about this entire operation at first operating within the avidya. So he says this he does because evidently he does not intend to kill or destroy it, but delight of existence being his eternal business and a harmony of various strains, not a sweet but monotonous melody, the method of his music, he wishes to include the lower notes. And by surcharging them with a deeper and finer significance, get more delight out of them than was possible in the cruder formulation. So in this itself, we get the sense of something else, something higher, that is blowing a different music into something lower. And in blowing that music, it gets notes out of that lower thing that it did not have before. But it does not refer to a transformation of that lower thing, that has been made into something new. See, it's being surcharged by something else that is making it yield other properties of its own reality than it was capable of without this surcharging. Also, this whole issue of the domination. He can deal harshly enough with them, even to trampling them underfoot, when he is bent on perfection and they are rebellious. And that indeed is the true inmost aim and meaning of ethics, discipline and mestizos, to lessen and tame. The word lessen he is using as a verb over here. Purify and prepare to be fit instruments, the vital and physical and lower mental life, so that they may be transformed into notes of the higher mental and eventually the supramental harmony, but not to mutilate and destroy them. So all our rules, all our ethics, all our moralities have a place in the journey of the soul, and that place is to prepare the ground by keeping these other operations within the ambit of a higher aim of life. Ultimately, these things have to themselves be transformed. And if they are too much brought under the control of some higher ethical power, then they do get maimed. They get crippled, as it were. But before they can get crippled, it is necessary for the higher power, the mentality in this case, to let them have a higher expression as well, to open up a higher expression in them. So this is the whole thing about ascent and integration. As I was reading that part, I was thinking about, again, the cosmic gods. When we talk about, you know, the triple soul forces, we also think about the cosmic gods in Hinduism. For example, Shiva, who, when he dances on top of the small demon called Apasmara. He is trampling it underfoot, exactly as he says over there, but not completely destroying it. He has lessened its power, the power of forgetfulness, but it is there nevertheless, because it's not being completely transformed. If he wishes, he can probably transform it, being a devata of the supermind. But he is operating within the avidya, and within the avidya, he allows these powers a kind of a lessened and kind of, you know, sort of operation just within a kind of nominal scope. but allows much more the expression of the divine dance to occur on top of that forgetfulness.
Devashish, I had one question that, you know, what is the, can you hear me?
Yes.
What is the root of these moralities? And I mean, can we say that it's actually coming from that deep part, with which is ultimately the aim of that supramental harmony? That deep part is sort of coming through distorted medium, which is why our morality is not exactly equal to that unifying spirit of the supermind.
Yes, exactly. As I was mentioning earlier, this very thing, in fact, that at the mental level, we have on the one hand a kind of a reason which can be pragmatic and which can give us various kinds of ways to lead our life a little better than, you know, without that reason. So we can actually just make compromises based on ethics, and ethics which allows us to, you know, sort of lead a more reasonable collective life. But all this is not all there is to it. There is also the fact that in ethics, there is a kind of reflection of a higher principle. But that higher principle of unity, of harmony, of divine unity and harmony is being reflected through a lower medium, which is the medium of the mind. And at that level, it is also becoming fragmented, it is becoming fossilized. And so that lower, kind or type, mode of consciousness is what causes this distortion that we see in ethics. And also, it is not the original power of unity. So what happens is that the lower powers on which it turns its gaze don't completely accept it. That's why when Sri Aurobindo describes it over here, he's talking about a domination, he's talking about trampling underfoot, dealing harshly, etc. And evidently that is something that can be done, but it is not something which is perfect and which is totally desirable. It has to be done so long as there are disjunctions between levels of consciousness. But nevertheless, the whole of the history of civilization is one where we've always had somebody or the other who has proposed that they know more or better than somebody else and has tried to dominate them, but not entirely succeeded, because whoever it is that they try to dominate has some principle of truth by themselves which cannot be fully understood until one has reached that root of unity. Hello, I can't. Is anybody speaking? I couldn't hear anybody.
No one was speaking. Shall we read the next one? Meera, you want to read?
With a view to an all-round heightening, deepening, and subtler, finer, and richer intensification is the secret spirit's way from the beginning. The plant soul takes, as we may say, a nervous material view of its whole physical existence so as to get out of it all the vital physical intensity possible. For it seems to have some intense excitations of a mute life vibration in it. Perhaps, though that is difficult for us to imagine, more intense relatively to its lower rudimentary scale than the animal and body in its higher and more powerful scale could tolerate. The animal being takes a mentalized sense view of its vital and physical existence so as to get out of it all the sense value possible. Much acuter in many respects than man's, as mere sensation or sense emotion or satisfaction of vital desire and pleasure. Man, looking downward from the plane of will and intelligence, abandons these lower intensities. But in order to get out of mind and life and sense, a higher intensity in other values, intellectual, aesthetic, moral, spiritual, mentally dynamic or practical, as he terms it. By these higher elements, he enlarges, subtilizes, and elevates his use of life values. He does not abandon the animal reactions and enjoyments, but more lucidly, finely, and sensitively mentalizes them. This he does even on his normal and his lower levels, but as he develops, he puts his lower being to a severer test, begins to demand from it on pain of rejection something like a transformation. That is the mind's way of preparing for a spiritual life still beyond it.
I think this paragraph covers, in a way, sort of summarizes some of the things we have already talked about. So unless there are any comments or questions, we can move further.
Debashisda, in the Ashtanga Yoga, the first five are relevant to the previous section, the previous paragraph. It is to train the lower nature. I think it's asana, pranayama, brahmacharya, aparigraha. There is one more, anga. Then the last three is dhyana, dharana, dhyana, samadhi, which mm-hmm. are of the, I would think, about the higher nature.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yes. So, there is the control of the vital and mm-hmm. The making ready of the power of that instrument for the utilization of a higher spiritual preparation.
So Devashishda, this chapter, you know, in some ways the scale of the scale that is being addressed is so vast that it kind of makes the magnitude of the task very overwhelming, you know. Whereas if you look at many chapters, when you read in Savitri or Synthesis Yoga, they have a more of a tendency to invigorate the sadhana. Whereas some of these, I mean, something especially I feel it in this, because it kind of has a because I think he's speaking of very large scales. It has a tendency to really expose the magnitude.
Yeah, but also you see, he's talking over here so far about different principles of consciousness without actually introducing any uniting or original principle. So all we actually see so far, as he has talked so far, is the fact that higher principles, particularly of mind, can prepare the lower nature to some extent. And that's all that he has said so far, that we can apply to our own nature. And I don't think that can be something daunting. That can be a preparation. More can be said about it, and that can be said about it in terms of higher or deeper principles, whether the psychic or the supramental, or even if we don't go up to the supramental, what he calls the mental spiritual, or the higher mental powers of consciousness. So those certainly have different kind of operation on the lower. But I think we can still take heart in what he's saying over here, in the sense that as we, I think this last paragraph, in fact, is very heartening, because in fact, as we start raising the pitch of our sadhana, we find that the demand that we make of our vital nature is of a different order. It does not necessarily disappear right away, whatever its own understanding is. It's you see, in sadhana, we are actually pulling a kind of a motley being along. There's so many different parts of the nature that are coming along for the ride. Many of them don't even know where the whole thing is moving and whether they're interested in coming along or not. But as the demand of the sadhana increases, there is also a certain kind of a higher pitch in the demand, or in the kind of expectation on these lower parts and their usual routine activities, their wishes, desires, and modalities of action. And that higher pitch becomes, in a sense, something that these lower parts begin to understand. They begin to understand that, you know, they can, in a sense, you know, give way to some other demand, a greater demand, higher demand, and experience a different modality of action and find enjoyment in that too. A different kind of enjoyment, but a higher form of enjoyment. So I think this is really the kind of heartening factor in this. You know, the sort of even the modification is a partial transformation. It's all through stages leading to an ultimate and full transformation.
Thank you very much.
Rosemary, do you want to read the next paragraph?
Yes. But man not only turns his gaze downward and around him.
Actually, we just read that. The next one.
The next one?
Yeah.
I think she was reading the right one, right?
Yeah, because this next one is a big one.
Yeah, but man
I
not
think
only
it,
turns his
oh,
case
okay,
downward.
I'm sorry.
Okay, but man not only turns his gaze downward and around him when he has reached his higher level, but upward towards what is above him and inward towards what is occult within him. In him not only the downward gaze of the universal being in the evolution has become conscious, but its conscious upward and inward gaze also develops. The animal lives as if satisfied with what nature has done for it. If there is any upward gaze of the secret spirit within its animal being, it has nothing consciously to do with it. That is still nature's business. It is man who first makes his upward gaze consciously his own business. For already by his possession of intelligent will, the formed ray of the gnosis, though it be, he begins to put on the double nature of Satchidananda. He is no longer like the animal, an undeveloped conscious being entirely driven by Prakriti, a slave of the executive force, played with by the mechanical energies of nature, but has begun to be a developing conscious soul or Purusha, interfering with what was her sole affair, wishing to have a say in it and eventually to be the master. He cannot do it yet. He is too much in her meshes, too much involved in her established mechanism. But he feels, though as yet too vaguely and uncertainly, that the spirit within him wishes to rise to yet higher heights, to widen its bounds. Something within, something occult, knows that it is not the intention of the deeper conscious soul nature, the Purusha Prakriti, to be satisfied with his present lowness and limitations. To climb to higher altitudes, to get a greater scope, to transform his lower nature, this is always a natural impulse of man as soon as he has made his place for himself in the physical and vital world of Earth and has a little leisure to consider his further possibilities. It must be so, not because of any false and pitiful imaginative illusion in him, but first because he is the imperfect, still developing mental being and must strive for more development, for perfection, and still more because he is capable, unlike other terrestrial creatures, of becoming aware of what is deeper than mind, of the soul within him, and of what is above the mind, of supermind, of spirit, capable of opening to it, admitting it, rising towards it, taking hold of it. It is in his human nature, in all human nature, to exceed itself by conscious evolution, to climb beyond what he is. Not individuals only, but in time, the race also, in a general rule of being and living, if not in all its members, can have the hope, if it develops a sufficient will, to rise beyond the imperfections of our present very undivine nature and to ascend at least to a superior humanity, to rise nearer, even if it cannot absolutely reach, to divine manhood or supermanhood. At any rate, it is the compulsion of evolutionary nature in him to strive to develop upward, to erect the ideal, to make the endeavor.
So here we find that Sri Aurobindo introduces that other movement that becomes really predominant at the level of the human being. The ascent becomes conscious. It is not anymore the unconscious ascent of universal nature, of Prakriti force, but a conscious ascent, which is an operation of the waking Purusha within the human being. And it is this, in fact, that one may say existentially characterizes the human being from other creatures. See, you may find, as he says, that plant is a somnambulist, is a dreamer. In it, the Prakriti force is wrapped up in a kind of nervous sleep, in a sleep of the nervous being. In the animal, there is a greater awakening of some kind of a vital mind, but still it is conditioned almost completely by the Prakriti of vital mind. That is its conditioning, in which it is satisfied, as he says, because it knows nothing more that anything can be beyond it. If there is something beyond it, that is only a power of Prakriti itself to evolve higher aspirations to higher expressions universally. But in the human being, there is a certain kind of instability. That instability is the very essence of being human. It is what gives us our sense of beings directed towards the future. It gives us our specific or special orientation in time or towards time. So we always have a sense, even of the kind of, you know, more ordinary life, of a destiny, of a plotting, of a planning, of wanting to achieve something that gives us our sense of future orientation. Ultimately, the root of that future orientation is this fact that Purusha within us has awoken and is not satisfied with what Prakriti has established in us. And it is this seeking to outgrow, to exceed, to transcend the conditioning of Prakriti that gives the future orientation of human goals, of human ideals, of aspirations that cannot be satisfied, of what elsewhere in this book Sri Aurobindo calls the divine discontent of the human being. So that is what helps us to, make the journey and to exceed what he calls the prakritic action. And is the upward gaze, the gaze upward, that coexists with the downward gaze. This is exactly why, when he's talking about the mind turning its gaze downward upon the other beings, but not being able to fully achieve mastery over them, we have to take that particular idea along with this other sort of movement upwards, because this movement upwards is a greater aid to bringing a fuller power of consciousness. We are constantly aware that whatever it is that nature has developed in us through her own prakritic force is not enough. That awareness itself is the very sign and stamp of the Purusha within us. That is what makes us seek to go beyond, to find that power, to rise into the supermind. And it is truly a wonderful thing because otherwise, you know, even I would say that to rest content at recognizing the fact that there is a power of soul that can separate itself from Prakriti, can separate a Purusha that can actually experience its independence from all conditionings, is a good thing, but it is not enough. Because it is only when one can find some sort of a power of transformation that can turn its gaze downwards from a greater height that brings about a full harmonious, you know, inclusion, integration, which is the word he is using, that we can be satisfied. And that is, in a sense, what leads towards the fullness of the solution that Sri Aurobindo is proposing, which is that not even some kind of nominal liberation from the conditioning forces of Prakriti, but the finding of a power which can integrate the lower powers in a transformed existence. In other words, the discovery of an integral consciousness. And it is that discovery which gives us the very sense of time, the sense of the future, and the sense of human destiny.
Debashista, can we say that the urge towards ascension in its impure form is actually the ambition, or vital ambition, that people have to grow and to conquer and to colonize, to buy more than one needs, and all those?
It's the distortion of that. Of course, in it, all other kinds of things are also, sort of forces active in these kind of things. But the essence of any sense of an ideal, whether it be ambition, anything that gives us future orientation, anything that gives us a sense of something to be done, an aim, a goal, whether it is to, you know, devour all others and make oneself supreme, or to rise to a supreme height where all are seen as oneself, these are various formulations of ultimately some kind of an urge to arrive at full mastery and integration of nature.
So historically, it seems that the European nations were more active in expansion than, let's say, the Indic nations or even any other nation in Asia. So, did they have more of the urge to ascension than the rest?
No, not necessarily. It's just where it is acting. I mean, you see, the expression is no proof of the urge. The urge may be completely invisible. So, the urge to ascend is something that may have expressed itself in the Indic or the Asian sort of cultures as a dissatisfaction with the kind of limitations of Prakriti and the discovery of at least the liberation out of Prakriti. So that is where that urge went. But urge can go further and seek, as it does with Sri Aurobindo, to bring a power of spiritual force into the integration of the lower nature. On the other hand, if we look at the ambitions and, you know, the sort of expansionist notions of the West, we see that there is a certain kind of urge over there to deal with the nature. Now, the higher aspects of this have to do with arriving at some sort of a universal power of enjoyment, universal power of sort of collective sharing, a certain power of finding how to live harmoniously through creating political solutions, which are sort of, you know, social utopias. That is the urge or the aspiration towards an integrated sort of nature life, a perfection of the Prakriti. So I think in some way aspiration can express itself whether at the Prakritic level or at the higher level, the level moving out of its the reaches of Prakriti, in a certain kind of will towards perfection, towards the achievement of a greater power of fulfillment, the expression may differ, and the expression will be distorted until we can find the you know higher power itself.
But is there not a danger of expanding materially? It might be an expression of the aspiration, but there is no limit to the expansion that one can go through. Like, one never reaches the point of satisfaction. Whereas if the expansion happens inward and upward, there could be a point where one is happier or more satisfied than this kind of restless expansion.
Yeah, but you know, actually, with the kind of reasoning you provided, Sri Aurobindo uses almost exactly the opposite reasoning in the first two chapters there, with the materialist denial and the refusal of the ascetic. He's saying over there that the material impulse will lead you to a point where inevitably you will cross over its boundaries, while the spiritual refusal will lead you to a kind of a infinite sort of, you know, entry into the unmanifest from which there is no return. So the argument can be made either way, you see. He's saying actually the materialist denial has got some hope in the future, but the refusal of the ascetic ultimately is too satisfied in its own sublime unthinkable and doesn't need to do anything about the transformation of nature.
Yeah, he uses the very dissatisfaction to the advantage.
Yes.
It's interesting that I was just thinking of asking that if we could think of a world where everyone is putting an effort to, you know, sort of step back and not act or not react and, you know, look at things, witness things, but not really function or rather, you know, not at all driven by nature. If we think of this, that sort of a world, I was thinking of asking whether that will really work, or is it that it is, indispensable to actually come into the battlefield and then experience, I mean, let the Prakriti experience certain things, and then that creates that discontent, and then that will create that aspiration to go upward or develop.
It's ultimately it boils down to that old problem of the Purusha and the Prakriti. And, you know, the Purusha can find its freedom from the Prakriti and become a pure witness, but it loses the world thereby. And the power of transformation or the power of modification of the nature is lost. While if you drop down into the Prakriti, then you start having the problem of all kinds of deficiencies of the nature, which are rubbing other deficiencies the wrong way and making you feel very unhappy sometimes. But, you know, there's a quotation, Sri Aurobindo quotes from a kind of a Greek philosopher, Heraclitus, who says, war is the father of all things. And that is the nature of Prakriti. War is the father, and he agrees with him. He says, war is the father of all things, because it is through war, through the fact that we have differences with others, that the aspiration for harmony grows in nature, in Prakriti. And that ultimately can bring about an integration, a transformation, whereas to run away from it and enter into the heights, into the witness, into the Purusha, can give one greater amount of power over the Prakriti, but also it is of no avail if one tries to live there without bringing it into engagement in the world. Ultimately, this also becomes the whole issue of the Gita, where it may be very easy for you know, Arjuna to say, though Sri Krishna says to him, he doesn't think it's so easy for him. Being a Kshatriya, he can only say that I'll go off to the mountaintop and meditate over there. But his nature will remain what it is. And only by actually engaging the nature at a higher level to transforming it, can he do something good for himself as well as for the whole world, for the evolution. Because thereby the power of a higher consciousness can become manifest in Prakriti.
Right. Like that rasa grahan, and that thing, I was thinking of that this particular manifestation is supposed to get that rasa grahan from this ignorance to knowledge.
Yes, no doubt. It is the delight that is, hidden in things that we experience as undelight, as he says, that ultimately reveals itself to be the supreme delight that is the parent or the source of all things in nature.
Also, I was thinking of asking about that particular part. Actually, it relates to what Lopa was saying. In a general rule of being and living, if not in all its members, that when she was talking about the Western, culture or whatever, that general rule of being and living, can it be said that relates to that certain rules and principles that more of the Western side, I think, I'm not sure. Anyway, general humanity takes up, which we sort of call morality or whatever. I was thinking that whether this relates to that sort of thing. Like not individuals only, but in time the race also, in a general rule of being and living, if not in all its members.
Yeah, I think he's talking over here not of morality, but of that, you know, kind of higher spiritual power. So, you know, right now only sporadic individuals, but you may be right in the sense that, you see, when we are talking about the difference between East and West, that is one of the chief differences. The difference is that the West has proceeded in a kind of a direction where they have tried, I mean, in the highest sense, in the spiritual sense, towards the perfection of the collective life, towards the perfection of society, and towards the achievement of what he's saying there, finding a general rule of being and living. The whole notion of the public space, of society as an entity, is a kind of much more developed idea and consciousness actually in the West than it was in pre-modern India. In pre-modern India, the notion was much more individualistic from that point of view, from the point of view of experience. The society existed ultimately for the experience of the individual and his own individual moksha or his own individual, you know, spiritual liberation. But to think of the society as a kind of a power of expression of consciousness, as a unit, is something which was not that developed. The aspiration for a perfected society was not something, I mean, in the mass, something that can have general principles, that as a mass, in mass, people can have the ideal, the aim, the goal of a spiritual manifestation.
So is the concept of society itself a vital formulation, or is it coming from more of a mental formulation, this concept of organizing society?
It's not necessarily either vital or mental. It has its expressions both in the vital and the mental. You have, for example, you know, the kind of group at the animal level, even the insect level, and that kind of organized society is working through a sort of what Mother calls the genius of the group. You know, there's a certain occult formation which controls the entire group, the hive or the pack or whatever. But at the mental level, it becomes a sort of an ideal of finding the proper ethical principles, the rules by which individuals can find, you know, what in the Indian sort of system becomes known as Ram Rajya, you know, which Gandhi also brought up once again. Basically, he was trying to find proper ethical rules by which we can have some sort of a harmonious society. But these are not the roots of the idea of society as a reality. The root is ultimately supramental. It is a kingdom of God on earth. It is the one being manifesting in multiple bodies for the play of divine delight.
So there was just another question. It's kind of a little unrelated, and this came up when you spoke about how the concept of cause and effect. So in the supermind, when the knowledge and will are united, do we still have this cause and effect relationship between things, or is that only in the lower prakriti that this would be there?
Well, that is a very, very profound question, actually, and it relates also to the nature of time in the supermind. This question is very well dealt with. It's too complex to enter into right now, but it's very well dealt with in the last chapter of the Synthesis of Yoga, where he's saying that from a certain point of view, everything coexists. There is no cause and effect at one level of the supermind. But there are other levels of the supermind where supermind sees its own action in multiple ways. And one of them, the lowest one, is where it can, while at the same time knowing everything seamlessly to have already occurred, can also experience it as having a certain kind of a causal relationship in time.
Thank you, Devash. I'll go back to that chapter some other time. Thank you.
I think in some chapter in the Light Divine where he's talking about Maya, there he touches upon the fact that Maya is the force that puts order to the supramental creation, and without it things would not have a cause and effect, and this world would be ungraspable by the mind and the lower parts, right?
Yeah, right. You see, the whole creation of time and space are, you know, these are, I mean, functions of the supermind. Supermind creates time and space exactly for the sense of a play, which proceeds through beginnings, middles, and ends. It is, from a certain point of view, an illusion. But to call it an illusion is to not understand the dimension of meaning that it represents. It is a manifestation and a representation, a new possibility of Satchidananda, as Sri Aurobindo puts it somewhere.
If you see the progress a person makes in one lifetime, from level to level, let's say he's trying to live a life from within, and at every level he's reaching a little step, and then he sees a saturation, and actually there is a point where he feels sorry that he's human, or that he's never happy. He has to move on to the next. So from a very pessimistic point of view, it is possible that he will get disheartened that no matter what he is trying, he is not reaching that happiness that he is trying to reach.
Yes, that's true. But you see, also to human nature, that's part of the whole, mystery of the manifestation, that to human nature, there is a kind of a intuition of its own divinity. And that ultimately is what prevents us from getting disheartened, because we know that there is a certain solution. It is only a refusal to be stuck in half solutions that can, sort of keep us going. The acceptance of a half solution is a frustration to the intuition of divinity within us. It has been done because throughout the past we keep arriving at certain stations and calling that the solution. But at the same time, there have been people who have challenged it. So the march of humanity continues. Even the atheistic and materialistic kind of denials of spirituality can be a help from that point of view, because they point to the fact that something has not been reached, something is not yet truly, achieved. Western philosophies have also helped in this. There are a number of modern or contemporary philosophers who have seen somewhere this problem of the Purusha and the Prakriti and the dichotomy between them, and have scrupulously avoided allowing the human consciousness to rest in either one, and recognizing the fact that it is only an intervention of some kind, almost like a messianic or an avataric kind of, possibility that can overcome it. But until that is reached, it is not worthy of us to call halt to our own progress, even though it is a failure. Again, what you talked about is also captured in the Greeks. The mother has said that the Greeks had a very tragic consciousness. They always looked upon these kind of tragic factors of human existence and gave images for them. And the whole myth of Sisyphus is a very kind of, telling, metaphor of this fact of human existence pushing the weight of a rock up the mountain every morning and being beholden to it rolling down to the bottom every night and starting all over again the next day, never finding a resting place which it can call its goal. But this is a kind of a image of some sort of a fatalism.
Mm-hmm.
Ultimately, our life is not a fatalism. It carries within itself the intuition of a divinity that will be fulfilled.
Mm-hmm.
And it may not be by our own unaided effort, but we also await the divine intervention, that can make it happen.
But how realist tragedy and fatalism outside of the mind?
Tragedy and fatalism outside of the mind, it is a mind-created thing. It is a mind-created image. There is no doubt it's a mind-created image. It is a perception of one's own condition being presented or represented by the mind. So, you are quite right about that.
So the key would be to love the journey.
Absolutely. Because the journey is also the journey of delight.
Mm-hmm.
There's a place where T.S. Eliot, talking about the Gita, says, he says, not farewell, but fare forward, voyagers. So it's in that faring forward that the delight exists.
Mm-hmm. In Vaishnav cult, it is called Abhishar, like Radha is going to meet Krishna. It's always dark and dangerous. She's not meeting Krishna, but she's still going forward to do it.
Yeah.
Okay, you want to read?
Oh man, it's a long one.
Shall we read the next?
But where is the limit of effectuation in the evolutionary beings self-becoming by self-exceeding? In mind itself, there are grades of the series, and each grade again is a series in itself. There are successive elevations, which we may conveniently call planes and subplanes of the mental consciousness and the mental being. The development of our mental self is largely an ascent of the stair. We can take our stand on any one of them, while yet maintaining a dependence on the lower stages and a power of occasional ascension to higher levels, or of a response to influences from our being superior strata. At present, we still normally take our first secure stand on the lowest subplane of the intelligence, which we may call the physical mental, because it depends for its evidence of fact and sense of reality on the physical brain, the physical sense mind, the physical sense organs. There we are the physical man who attaches most importance to objective things and to his outer life, has little intensity of the subjective or inner existence, and subordinates whatever he has of it to the greater claims of exterior reality. The physical man has a vital part, but it is mainly made up of the smaller instinctive and impulsive formations of life consciousness emerging from the subconscient, along with the customary crowd or round of sensations, desires, hopes, feelings, satisfactions, which are dependent on external things and external contacts and concerned with the practical, the immediately realizable and possible, the habitual, the common and average. He has a mental part, but this too is customary, traditional, practical, objective, and respects what belongs to the domain of mind, mostly for its utility for the support, comfort, use, satisfaction and entertainment of his physical and sensational existence. For the physical mind takes its stand on matter and the material world, on the body and the bodily life, on sense experience, and on a normal, practical mentality and its experience. All that is not of this order. The physical mind builds up as a restricted superstructure dependent upon the external sense mentality. Even so, it regards these higher contents of life as either helpful adjuncts or a superfluous but pleasant luxury of imaginations, feelings, thought abstractions. Not as inner realities, or even if it receives them as realities, it does not feel them concretely and substantially in their own proper substance, subtler than the physical substance and its grosser concreteness. It treats them as a subjective, less substantial extension from physical realities. It is inevitable that the human being should thus take his first stand on matter and give the external fact and external existence its due importance. For this is nature's first provision for our existence, on which she insists greatly. The physical man is emphasized in us and is multiplied abundantly in the world by her as her force for conservation of the secure, if somewhat inert, material basis on which she can maintain herself while she attempts her higher human developments. But in this mental formation, there is no power for progress or only for a material progress. It is our first mental status, but the mental being cannot remain always at this lowest rung of the human evolutionary ladder.
So Sri Aurobindo is proceeding to look at the various rungs of the mind, as he calls them over there, and each one of them, as he is pointing out, has got within it all the others. That's the whole thing about the sort of, you know, cross linkages between levels of consciousness and the grades of the series, and each grade again is a series in itself, successive elevations, which we may call planes and subplanes of the mental consciousness and the mental being. And there he is, in this particular paragraph, he is taking up the whole physical mind, the physical mental, and seeing or showing or demonstrating how the physical mental contains within itself the other, sort of levels. Just, I need to take 1 second and take a phone call. Just hold on, please, 1 second. There's some little bit of an emergency. Somebody is coming to pick something up. Where were we? Talking about the physical mind, or the physical mental, and how that has within it a vital part and a mental part, a physical part, a vital part, and a mental part. So that's how he divides up each one of these planes of consciousness, and he goes through a description of how these operate under the conditions of the physical mind. There is a life part to it, but that life consciousness operates under the conditions of the physical consciousness of the physical mind. The physical man has a vital part, but it is mainly made up of the smaller instinctive and impulsive formations of life consciousness emerging from the subconscious, along with a customary crowd or round of sensations, desires, hopes, feelings, satisfactions, which are dependent on external things and external contacts and concerned with the practical, the immediately realizable and possible, the habitual, the common and average. So it is really what defines the operation of the vital in the physical mind is the scope of the world in which it exists and from which it gets its, you know, sort of its stimuli, its and responds to the stimuli of these particular kinds of realities. These realities are realities of the physical world, of objective realities and practical realities, as he says over there. Similarly, the physical mind takes its stand on matter and the material world, on the body and the bodily life, on sense experience and on a normal practical mentality and its experience. All that is not of this order, the physical mind builds up as a restricted superstructure dependent upon the external sense mentality. So it does not have enough reality for anything outside of what it can actually sense, what is around it. So this is the ultimately the physical mind, and this physical mind is restricted to this kind of an operation, and allows life and mentality only to operate within its limits of the objective world in which it moves and senses things. I think since he is going to go into all the levels of the mind, he starts with this physical mind and then moves on to the vital mind and the mind of pure intelligence. We may do better to, you know, reconsider this from the very beginning next time. And I am a little bit constrained today because I have to receive somebody to give them something. So if you wish, we can sort of, you know, terminate today at this point with a meditation.